This is Ben Smith. I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hey folks, this is Ben. This is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Many thanks for joining me as always. If you're a regular listener, welcome back. If you're new to the podcast, welcome along. Where the bloody hell have you been? We're over 70 chats in here. You've got some catching up to do, my friend. But please do enjoy that process. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by the Charcoal Book Club, the world's first book of the month club dedicated exclusively to photo books. Here's how it works. Each month, Charcoal works with the most respected photographers and publishers in the industry to send hand-picked books directly to your door. Whether you're a professional artist or photographer with a stock library or a novice who's just beginning to build their collection, Charcoal Book Club is an easy and affordable way to stay up to date on the most essential work in contemporary photography. The club offers free shipping to the UK, Canada and the US, and members get exclusive perks such as signed copies, access to rare titles and more. January's book, for example, is the much-lauded Night Procession by acclaimed British photographer Stephen Gill. This is not only a favourite at Charcoal, but it is also receiving widespread plaudits as a contender for the best photo book of 2017, after its recent release at Paris Photo. Now, it's quite an expensive book, especially outside the UK, where it's also very difficult to find. But if you were to join the Charcoal Book Club, you don't have to consider any of that. You can just sit on the sofa eating Jaffa Cakes, and the postman will simply bring it to your door. Leaving the best bit until last, Charcoal are extending a very special introductory offer exclusively to Small Voice listeners, a free photo book to new members. Go to charcoalbookclub.com and use the special code ASMALLVOICE when you sign up to receive your free book. And in all seriousness, this offer is for a limited time only, folks. I'm not giving you the hard sell. You probably know that's not my style, but it's a great offer. And quite honestly, I'm not quite sure how they can afford to do it. I'm pretty sure if you go around giving new members a free book forever, your numbers are not going to add up eventually. Not that I'm some kind of business genius, obviously. I can't even do my tax return properly. But in all seriousness, for the latest and greatest photo books delivered to your door with free shipping and no hassles, check out charcoalbookclub.com, where they're on a mission to inform the mind and inspire the soul. If you like the podcast, please tell someone else about it who you think might also enjoy it. Leave a short review on iTunes when you have a minute and consider making a one-off donation or signing up for a small monthly recurring subscription at bensmithphoto.com/asmallvoice. Also, if you think you might need a new website but you don't have time or can't be asked to do it yourself, let me know, ben@bensmithphoto.com. And for a ludicrously reasonable fee, I will sort the whole thing out for you. Concept, design, build, copy editing, after-sales support, everything using the Peerless Squarespace platform. This episode is part one of a two-part chat with Dr. Paul Lowe. Paul is a reader in documentary photography and the course leader of the Master's Programme in Photojournalism and Documentary Photography at the London College of Communication, part of the University of the Arts here in London. Before electing to put his cameras away in favour of a life in academia, Paul was an award-winning news and documentary photographer with several World Press Photo Awards under his belt and many years of experience covering breaking news the world over, including the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Romanian Revolution, Nelson Mandela's release, famine in Africa, the conflict in the former Yugoslavia, and the destruction of Grozny during the conflict in Chechnya. His pictures have appeared in such esteemed publications as Time, Newsweek, Life, Sunday Times Magazine, The Observer and The Independent, among others. His book Bosnians, documenting 10 years of the war and post-war situation in Bosnia, was published in April 2005 by Saki Books. His research interest focuses on the photography of conflict, and he's contributed chapters to the books Picturing Atrocity, Photography and Crisis, and Photography and Conflict. His most recent books include Photography Masterclass, published by Tebson Hutton, and Understanding Photojournalism, co-authored with Dr. Jenny Good and published by Bloomsbury Academic Press. So two parts such as this are a very unusual thing, as regular listeners will know. This is the second one I've done. The only other one was with Harry Borden back in the day. And it's not something I ever particularly anticipate or intend, but occasionally the conversation runs long. And Paul is someone who had a very successful career as a jobbing photojournalist and then gave that all up to pursue an academic career. has a lot of interesting stuff to say, not only about his early years in the field, but also on the current state of the industry, the things he tries to teach his students, and some of the key professional and ethical issues of our times. So I wanted to bring all that to you because there's a lot of interesting stuff in there. This episode tracks his early years, cutting his teeth on some of the defining news stories of the late 20th century, up to the war in Bosnia. And then the next episode will cover Bosnia, the conflict for which he is perhaps best remembered, and his transition to teaching. So enjoy part one of this wide-ranging chat with Paul Lowe. What I'd love to do really is sort of chart your trajectory really from, you know, because you're quite unusual in the sense that you are someone who moved from being a jobbing photographer to a life of academia, and that's something I'd really love to sort of explore. And I do want to go back to, you know, the old days really. It occurred to me that...
Good old days.
Yeah, you know, like some of your MA students... Shocking though it is, we're not even born.
Absolutely, yeah. Back, many of them, to be honest with you. Yeah.
When I mean, you were...
It is quite scary thinking back that your career is now almost 30 years.
Yeah.
And that's quite a sobering thought.
Yeah. And how quickly that time has passed. Because that was, it was a kind of special kind of moment for me in a way, because that's when I sort of fell in love with photojournalism at that point.
Sure.
And you were kind of one of the guys who was out there knocking it out the park all the time and getting... you know, winning awards in the World Press and all that, for whatever that's worth. I think it's probably worth something. So we might as well just go chronologically.
Sure.
How did you get interested in photography initially?
Well, when I was a sort of 17, 18-year-old, I, like many people, didn't know quite what I wanted to do in my life. But I decided to study history at school, firstly, at A-level, and geography and things like that, and got very interested in current affairs. And I managed to get a place at Cambridge, probably more by luck than by merit. But anyway, I got into Clare College in Cambridge to read, initially to read philosophy. But before I went up to study, I said to my mum, I got really into photography, because one of my best friends at the time, his dad was a kind of keen amateur photographer, and he had this whole pile of, I forget which magazine it was, it was one of those serialized, you know, photography magazines, and he had a huge pile of them, and he gave them to me. And I was looking through those, and it had some of the great kind of documentary photojournalist photographers, and that's when my first exposure to them was through this page of this kind of amateur magazine. And I started looking at, you know, the Sunday Times, and, you know, I had a picture of James Nachtwey's on the wall, not a picture of him, but a picture by him on the wall in my room in Cambridge. So I asked my mum to buy me an SLR to take up with me. And I think she thought, like many things, it'd be a kind of flash in the pan. It was, you know, at the moment it was quite expensive. It's one of the most expensive things she'd ever bought for me, you know. And I thought, oh, it was a Fuji, I think it was a Fuji, if I remember rightly, with a 50mm lens, you know. And I started taking pictures when I was at Cambridge of ducks on the lawns and people punting and all the kind of cliches. But, you know, got more and more into it. And about halfway through my degree, I'd switched by the end of my first year from philosophy to modern history and politics, because I just couldn't get my head around logic, basically. And I was very influenced by, to be honest, I was a kind of pretty out-and-out Marxist, you know, I was very influenced by kind of that area of theory, particularly Marxist theories of history. And, you know, was socially kind of active and socially concerned and so on, all the usual things that you are when you're a young sort of university rebel. And so I started to think that I was quite interested in working in the media in some way. So I did some student writing, wrote a little bit for the student newspapers, did some student photography for the university newspaper. And then a group of friends and myself, who were all very pro-Nicaragua, it was just after the Nicaraguan Revolution, we raised some funds, and we went out to Nicaragua in the summer to shoot a short documentary film about, you know, life after the revolution, the Sandinista regime and so on.
This was while you were still at college?
Yeah. This was in my, I think between my second and third years in the summer there. And we did get a professional sound recordist to come with us to kind of do that side, because that's quite technical. But we got a 16mm film camera, and I bought a couple of better Canon SLRs. And so I was doing the camera work for the film and also doing the stills photography. And I really enjoyed the process. It was a wonderful trip. We spent, you know, 6 weeks or something in traveling around Nicaragua. And it was kind of, you know, this was being a journalist. It was kind of going and doing the story and so on. I mean, not much was happening, to be honest with you, but we were doing a lot of daily life stuff in villages, and, you know, there were some demonstrations and all this kind of thing. And actually, in the end, the film never quite got made. We never finished it because we could never find the resources to do all the post-production, get it out there and so on. So I have no idea what actually happened to it. But the photographs that I took, you know, did still exist. And I put together, you know, a portfolio of pictures, and I thought, oh, I've done some, you know, these are great. I mean, I'm a journalist, you know, I'm a photographer. And so that kind of made me realize that, you know, working with the camera, with the photographic camera, was this fantastic solo effort, because, you know, it's just you and your bag of film and a couple of cameras, and you can pretty much go anywhere with very little baggage. You know, if you're working as a print journalist, most print journalists, particularly at that time, worked for a publication, and so you're kind of tied to that publication. And obviously you're writing in your own language, so you're writing in English or in German or whatever. And by and large, it's not that translatable. You know, most famous journalists are famous in their own language group and not outside of that. And so I realized that I thought photography was the thing I wanted to do, really.
So you were sort of attracted by the fact that there was a kind of universality to it, that, you know, there's no language barrier.
Yeah, I mean, you can publish the same picture in multiple places. I mean, obviously there are cultural differences and so on and so forth, but broadly speaking, you know, you don't have to translate the photograph itself. You can translate the caption, but the image itself is very mobile. It can be, you know, it can go almost anywhere.
Yeah.
So at the end of my, sort of in my third year, I started thinking, well, how am I going to become a photographer? You know, what am I going to do? And I realized there was a course at Newport that I'm sure you've heard of, what was then Gwent College of Higher Education, David Hearn's famous BTEC HND in documentary photography, which at that point was a two-year course. And I applied for that, and with my portfolio from Nicaragua, rather badly printed, as I realized in retrospect pictures.
Was that black and white stuff?
It was black and white, yeah. And went for the interview and was accepted. And that happened kind of halfway through my third year. So really my focus then just sort of shifted towards that. And I started thinking that was going to be what I was going to do. And so, you know, I went off to Newport. And that really was where I became a photographer, like many other people, I think.
Right. But just to take a little step back, getting into Cambridge was quite a big achievement. Were you a sort of comprehensive school kid?
I had an interesting journey with that. I grew up in Liverpool and went to a Catholic boys' grammar school, Christian Brothers, when I was up until the age of 16. And actually, until the age of 16, I was mostly kind of thought I was going to be doing sciences, to be honest with you. But then, for various reasons, my family, my mum and myself and my granddad, moved back to my grandfather's roots, which was in a place called near Darwen in Lancashire, because he'd come from the mill country up in there. And so when I was 16, we all moved back up to the north, you know, to Lancashire. And I went to what had been a boys' grammar school, which had then become a mixed comprehensive called Darwen Vale. And in many ways, that was kind of the making of me in some ways, because I think if I'd stayed in Liverpool, I would have been a kind of medium-sized fish in quite a big pool at that school, because it was a very high-achieving school. It was one of the best grammar schools in Liverpool and in the region and so on. But when I went to Darwen Vale, you know, I was kind of, my grades were pretty good. And so there was a particular history teacher there who really took me under his wing. And he kind of, you know, got me into the joys of history, as it were, and particularly modern history, as I said. And I was really interested in military history at the time as well, as a kind of big sort of, you know, World War II and Napoleonics and ancient Greeks and Romans and things like that. And I guess in some ways that's sort of where some of the interest in politics and the machinery of war, you know, came from, I suppose. And so because of that, he kind of helped me a lot, and he kind of, you know, got me into the mindset that I might be able to go to Cambridge. I had pretty good O-levels. And then I got the offer to go and be interviewed, was successful at that, and in fact I even got a scholarship to go to Clare. So, and then I did my A-levels and, you know, got all my grades and so on. So that's how I ended up in Cambridge.
So that's another great example of a sort of early mentor who had a massive, you know, influence on the course that your life took.
I mean, I think, you know, when we get to the end of this story, you know, I'm now back kind of where I probably would have been otherwise from Cambridge, I'm academic and I'm essentially in many ways a historian. So, you know, I've kind of come full circle really in a sense in that respect.
A very sort of, you've had a circuitous but extremely interesting journey.
But I suppose in a way the common theme of that has been the historical moment.
Right.
You know, I've been privileged in my photography career to be literally at the coalface of history and watching, you know, historical events happen in real time, as it were. And then in my academic career, I'm pretty much concerned mostly with how those things were photographed and documented and our responses to that.
We should get into some of that, definitely, but I want to figure out how what happened next. So did you enjoy Cambridge? Did you take to it?
I took to it in some senses. I didn't really go in, I mean, one of the regrets probably I had in some ways is I didn't really get into the Cambridge of the kind of popular imagination. In fact, I reacted rather badly to that, because I became, you know, as I said, a Marxist while I was there, which didn't really go very well with a lot of the. I mean, there are a couple of strands in places like Oxbridge. You know, there's always the kind of the hoorays and the kind of the rugby players, and then there's the, you know, the really real kind of hardcore academics. and the and then there's the dilettantes and the kind of socialites, and then there's typically a pretty big kind of left wing group, right. And I became part of that sort of left wing side of things. So got involved a little bit in student activism and so on, and also quite a lot in nightclubbing and ran as a DJ and things like that. So got quite into the social side of things, and I actually have come back to that. I mean, I enjoyed making things happen, making events happen, and that's also something that I do a lot of now. You know, I put on conferences and seminars and workshops where I kind of bring different people together and get them to have an interesting
time. It's funny how all these little skills...
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about it quite so explicitly before, but you're right, you're bringing some good things out there, yeah.
So what happened after Gwent?
Well, I mean, Gwent itself, or Newport, as we call the Newport Mafia, was obviously enormously influential.
And, so who are your contemporaries?
Well, I was there with Simon Norfolk. Right. We were in the same year. So we were best friends at the time. Tom Jenkins was in the year below me, I think. Who else was there around the time? Was there a whole range of people. Sean Tuig, who's still working quite a lot. And then, you know, the people around me, so people like Paul Rees was the technician at the time. Peter Fraser came in as a guest speaker. Patrick Sutherland was one of the tutors. Roger Hutchins was one of the tutors. So I got to meet and got exposed to a lot of people that were kind of aspirational, you know, who were one or two steps up. And Jocelyn Bain-Hogg as well, obviously, who gave me my very first job in photography just after I left Newport, which was photographing fortune tellers down in Brighton for some ill-fated small magazine he was editing called Elan, which never went anywhere, of course. But it was kind of my first proper, you know, assignment, as it were.
But
Newport, I learned a huge amount from. I mean, it was and still is a kind of absolutely seminal program for developing, you know, photojournalism and documentary photography. And in fact, we are, you know, I see the course I run now as in some ways a kind of bastard child of David's vision, really.
So what were the things that you learned that you've sort of remembered?
Well, I mean, one of the first things is just the work ethic. You know, I mean, the first year at Newport, the way it was structured then, you were out almost every day shooting pictures, processing film, coming back into the college, you know, getting your contact sheets, going and seeing a tutor. You know, it was like a cab rank. You know, there were kind of three or four tutors on call all day. And it was, looking back on it, the resourcing was incredible. You know, there's basically, you could shoot pictures in the morning, go out, process them, have a crit, go out again, shoot some more pictures, come back again, have another crit. You know, I mean, you could do it endlessly, really. Right. So that was one thing. You're just getting used to going out and shooting a lot of pictures. And I think it's this kind of idea of, you know, David's idea that we've taken on a little bit further with the course of, you know, I don't know if you know the way he developed this, but he worked with Bill Jay analysing hundreds of magazine stories and Magnum photographers' contact sheets. Kind of the classic photojournalistic, you know, Sunday Times, Life magazine style photography. And they worked out there were a number of different types of images that you see recurring a lot. Different kind of patterns. So you've got pictures of people doing some kind of activity, so what we call people at work pictures. You've got pictures of people interacting with each other, so what we call relationship pictures. You've got establishing shots that kind of set the scene. You've got quite often details or still lives. You've got portraits. And what we added to the mix was kind of what we call the moment or the sort of street picture. So a kind of picture that's full of life, effectively. And then you've got kind of horizontals and verticals, and you've got close-ups, you've got mid-shots, you've got wide shots. And by mixing together those types of images in various different combinations, you get the kind of classic magazine style layout of a, you know, a cover picture and 8 or 12 pictures inside the magazine that's easy to lay out for the editor and the art director and so on.
So it was literally the kind of building blocks of of the discipline being kind of interesting. Yeah, and I remember that basic kind of structure was clearly it's something that's still. Perhaps you're still using pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, certainly when I was working as a photojournalist, I used that or variations on it all the time, and we still use it very much on the course that I now currently run the MA at LCC, because it's still a really, really good diagnostic kind of training tool. You know, when you basically you're taking this big, complicated skill and breaking it down into small constituent elements, working on each of those in isolation under quite strict criteria, quite prescriptively, and then building that back up again back into the larger scale thing. So even with photographers that come on our course now who are quite well established, we still run them through the same set of exercises, because it's a way of kind of, you know, a lot of us work instinctively, and we don't really know quite why we've done something. So taking people back to the fundamentals and the basics and making them go through those exercises makes them realize, oh yeah, well, I didn't realize I was doing it that way, or why is that a good picture? You know, we really interrogate at a very fine level of detail. You know, if you'd moved you know, fractioning to the left and you'd focus slightly differently and use the 28 instead of a 35, then it would have been a better picture. You know?
Right.
So it's not just saying that's a good picture or that's a bad picture, it's saying that's a good picture because of these very precise elements and trying to identify what those are. And obviously the same goes for a bad picture. And then obviously then with Newport, the other thing was that, you know, they then taught you how to put those together into stories and the whole kind of research and planning and so on and so forth. But the other thing that they did very, very well was that they set that within a context of contemporary and historical, you know, photography at quite a high level. So even though it was a BTEC HND, which I think David wanted it to be because he wanted anyone to be able to do the course, didn't have to have A levels and a university degree. So although intellectually it was probably the equivalent of almost doing an MA, in terms of its level of qualification, it meant that anybody could get onto it. But one of the things that they had was Ian Walker, who was then the kind of history and theory tutor, ran this fantastic set of lectures about contemporary and historical documentary practice and exposed us to the full range of, you know, the greats, Walker Evans, Robert Adams, you know, William Eggleston, New Topographics, that whole kind of gave us that kind of really strong, not just photojournalism, but that kind of strong background in a whole range of creative documentary practice. And that was really, really important as well.
Mm, yeah. But your sort of focus was, or your leaning was towards kind of, you know, kind of traditional.
Actually, at the beginning, no. I mean, I partly because of Ian. You know, Ian opened the door, and Peter Fraser to an extent. I got very into kind of Eggleston and landscape photography and John Davis and New Topographics and that kind of area. And in fact, for a period, I was really struggling to try to be a kind of political landscape photographer, trying to do a project in the Welsh Valleys about the kind of, you know, the decay of the working classes and so on through landscapes. But I was frustrated because I couldn't quite translate the quite complicated ideas I had in my head into photographs. And so I was struggling with it. And then actually, one of the great things that Newport did was a thing called the Newport Survey, which for quite a long time, I mean, I think probably 10 or 15 years, every year of the course, the students went out and did in depth an aspect of life in Newport. And Newport was one of Britain's most average cities at the time, or towns. And so every year there was a different theme. So some years it was work, leisure, sport, economy. And the year we did it was education. And so I came up with the idea of going and following a fresher in their first week at Cambridge, because I thought, well, I'll go back to my roots, as it were. And it was a very simple story. And I just went off and found a girl who was going, I think, from Newport to Cambridge, and literally spent the first week of her, or a few days, following her to university. Very simple, black and white. But actually, it worked really, really well. And I thought, actually, I'm quite good at this. This is actually quite easy. Not easy, but you know, I got nice pictures. It was quite intimate. It was kind of full of energy and so on. And that kind of flipped the switch, really. I then went back to kind of where I'd started, which was, you know, classic, you know, documentary. And I think I did the projects I did for my Newport graduation were that story about her. I did a story about a young boy who was suffering from, sadly, terminal cancer. I did a story about a youth offenders prison in Wales, and I did a story about the Japanese community in South Wales, because that was when a lot of the valley coal mines had been closed down, and this whole new wave of all sorts of new strange industries had appeared, and one of them was a lot of Japanese electronics companies had moved in to make use of the female workforce. So that meant they'd brought a whole group of Japanese managers in. So there's this very strange little sort of new Japanese community in South Wales with a little mobile shop that went around selling, you know, bits and things to make sushi and so on.
Mm.
So I did that story because that was kind of one of the first stories that I did that actually had a kind of a journalistic angle. It was about something newsworthy or something different or something innovative and so on. So
right,
that
right.
was my kind of final exit portfolio, if you like, from Newport. Yeah.
So then what? You had to sort of figure out how to
I went to Cambridge between 82 and 86 and then Newport between 86 and 88. And at the end of the course, I'd become quite friendly with, I was a little bit older. Well, Newport was a bit like the course we teach now. It had a broad range of ages on it, but I was kind of in my mid-20s by that point. And I got on quite well with Roger when he'd come down, Roger Hutchins, and, you know, Daniel Meadows and Patrick and so on. And through them kind of realized that there was, you know, a kind of working world of photography that you could enter into. And in those days, one of the entry points was through the newspapers, the Guardian, the Sunday Telegraph, or whatever. And there were still the days when the way in was to essentially pester the picture editor with ideas for standalone single pictures, basically, that would go on like page 3 or page 6. So the idea was you would find some kind of quirky, visually led story idea. And then pitch it to one of the papers, and then that would be your entry point.
That would be a sort of standalone image with just a caption.
Exactly.
And
I think my first published picture was in the Guardian, and it was of some strange, rare Welsh Bible in some small chapel that had been discovered, and it was a picture of the priest holding this Bible in this Welsh chapel or whatever. And so I started doing that when I left, pitching those sorts of ideas to papers initially, with a little bit, not a huge amount of success, I have to say, a little bit of success. But the big breakthrough was that I also realized that you could work as an assistant. So I basically targeted quite a few of, particularly the network photographers, because I kind of got a connection to them through Roger. So that was people like Barry Lewis and Chris Pillitz. And I learned a huge amount from them. I basically just rang them up and said, I've just graduated from Newport, if you've got any work assisting. And this was the day of the pager. So if you remember those days where we all had little beepers, and when it went off, you had to find the nearest telephone. It was like kind of in one of those kind of movies where you're trying to get the ransom and you have to run to the nearest call box, And I just remember one day I was sitting, with some friends, and my beeper went off and it was Barry Lewis's number, and I ran to the phone and he said, "Oh, is that Paul?" I said, "Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, I've got a job. Are you free tomorrow?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'll be there." Yeah. And then worked with Barry and, as I said, Chris and a couple of other photographers, mostly doing portraits, actually, because that was the kind of work you need an assistant for. And not that I was necessarily wanted to be a portrait photographer, although I did end up doing quite a lot of editorial portraits at the early days, but partly because then you got to learn a huge amount about the business. If you're sitting with somebody in a car for 3 or 4 hours driving to location, you just talk. And I learned an enormous amount from Barry and Chris.
Yeah, it's almost like you sort of managed to fill in the gap in a way that would have been left after Newport, because it seems like you've got two options in a way. You can come in through doing a course and then just going out there and starting, trying to work. This was, I don't know if it's still the case, or you can assist, but you managed to do
a
bit of both.
Yeah, I was doing both simultaneously, really. Yeah.
And that's kind of almost like, you get something from that you wouldn't have necessarily got, like, learning how to light a portrait.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, Newport taught us the basics, but then I learned a huge amount more from, and the great thing about that was Barry and Chris had very different styles in life. I went on some great assignments with him. I went with Barry to East Berlin, in 1988, which was incredible, and went on a whole bunch of day shoots and a couple of day shoots, things like that. But learned a lot about the business from them as well, because they were very happy to kind of share, what was about network. And then after that, I started getting some editorial work. Basically, just went and saw a lot of clients, and I went to see a lot of them sort of one step below the big name clients. So I ended up doing a lot of work for Nursing Times magazine, for example.
Yeah, I used to do that.
Yeah,
so that was one of those magazines that was the kind of, these are the,
exactly,
there's two or three you can go to and they will give you a job.
And what was good about them is that I then started to be able to pitch ideas to them. So it went from kind of, because obviously they were interested in stories as well. And so I did a story for them about a community nurse that worked both sides of the divide in Northern Ireland, because this was towards the dying end of the Troubles. And so I started going out there quite a lot to Belfast, and covered the marching season in, I think it was 88, when there was a fair bit of, there was quite a lot of rioting, there was a lot of burning, obviously the Protestant marching season always has quite a lot of, there's quite a lot of conflict, associated with that. And so that was my first taste of kind of proper, news photography with dramatic things happening and petrol bombs being thrown and the police and RUC and the soldiers and so on. And I kind of got to see Gilles Perez at work, wow, the legendary Gilles, and things like that. And so I kind of cut my teeth a little bit there in a relatively secure way. But that then set me up. And then Barry, and the guys at Network were essentially looking for a young, energetic photographer who would go and cover anything. And so I was very fortunate to join Network at that point. And that was kind of a huge success for me and a huge boost to my career.
Yeah, we should explain what Network was for the younger listeners.
So Network was an agency that was founded by a group of, kind of left-wing-ish photographers. So people like John Sturrock, Mike Abrams, Mike Goldwater, Barry Lewis. And so it was a British agency, essentially. I mean, there were a few international people in it, but it was by and large a British agency, which was very, very successful through the 80s and even through into the 90s. And, the photographers that there were fantastic, you know, had a real kind of sense of why they were doing it, but were very, very good photographers. Judah Passo as well, for, it was in Network. And again, I learned a huge amount from them about the way they worked, the kind of subjects they covered and their approach. And it was great being in an agency because you had somewhere to go. You could go and sit in the office and hang out and have coffee and get, you know, while you're waiting for your film to be processed. This was the days of those of you that from London, you know, that they were in Clerkenwell. And it was when Clerkenwell was kind of the one of the central focal points for the industry because, you know, The Guardian was there, you know, a lot of the magazines were in that part of town, yeah. A lot of the agencies were there. And obviously in those days, you started to get your film processed. So you would go to Metro or one of the labs, drop your film off. And that meant you had an hour and a half, 2 hours to kill. So you'd go and meet in one of the local coffee shops and have a sandwich and sit and gossip and wait for your pager to go off.
Yeah. So, and you know, I guess you're sort of swapping notes and you're learning from other people just by, you know, just absolutely. By having
conversations. You're becoming part of the community, you know, and understanding how that works and getting connections and leads and so on.
So now you're in a position where you have to, your students have got a very different world. So, you know, to the one that you experienced when you were at their stage. So what, you know, fundamentally, what are the differences for them? I mean, what do you tell them they should do now? Because they can't do any of those things.
Well, I mean, it's not. I don't think it's quite true they can't do any of them because I think, you know, people still do get work editorially through more or less the same process of having good ideas and just going out there and getting yourself visible. I mean, I think, you know, I think we think a lot about this. And those, in some ways, they kind of were the good old, the kind of glory days when you could, through, you know, a lot of effort, I have to say, go and see a lot of clients, get a decent, you know, amount of editorial work. The flip side to that was, though, that was kind of pretty much all we did. And, you know, if you got a story in The Guardian or the Sunday Times magazine, that was fantastic. And that's kind of the be-all and end-all of what you were doing. Nowadays, you know, that's just one element of what you might be doing. So I think although the magazine market has shrunk financially and to an extent in terms of the number of stories they run, other opportunities have opened up that we didn't have any opportunity of doing. So I think the fact that now... I'm not saying it's easy by any stretch of the imagination, but it wasn't easy then either. You had to work hard. And I think people that have good, intelligent ideas that are well-researched, well thought through, obviously well executed, and have a lot of energy and patience and a, you know, relatively tough skin will still succeed. So I think the basic fundamental, you know, things that make people survive and prosper in the industry actually haven't changed.
Yeah.
The ways in which we work, the ways in which we get our work out there and our relationship to our audiences are very different, and in many ways actually much better than they were when I was working, because you now got the opportunity to much more strategically engage with a very specific audience, because we've got so many more ways of getting work out there than we had back in those days. So I think although we've lost certain things, some of the things we've lost were just the sort of weren't necessarily the gains that we've made in terms of being able to kind of work on stories that you really, really care about and get those stories across to an audience that isn't interested in them actually have probably outweighed that.
Right. Yeah. There's a more direct route to an audience, as it were.
Yeah. You can kind of really engage with a very specific audience in a very fine-grained way now, and then in ways that we couldn't do or were much more difficult to do then.
Do you find that your students are sort of have a more sophisticated understanding of than we would have done?
I think we can come back to that, to this bit later on, maybe when we get around to the course. But yes, I think we certainly try and work with them on having a more rounded and more in-depth strategy about what they're trying to do. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So in my strategy when I was working was get a story into the magazines.
Yeah.
And that was pretty much it.
Yeah.
Whereas now it would be get a story into a magazine and use that as a lever to get into with an NGO to then get a workout and a campaign to attract a certain small group of people that might actually be able to, you know, much more in depth, really.
Yeah. And obviously that also depends on, you know, which way you want to steer yourself.
Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. So, and I think the other thing now as well is that, you know, when I was working, there was a huge, well, I wouldn't say huge, but there was a significant gulf between kind of editorial photojournalism and documentary in that kind of classic reportage style documentary and what we might loosely call fine art documentary practice. And now that gulf is almost invisible. And I think, you know, that's one of the huge shifts, I would say, and probably the most important shifts of the last 20 or so years is the kind of collapse in a way of boundaries. So you've now got people who are working across a whole range of different ways of getting work out there, from the magazine page right the way through to the gallery with books and websites and all sorts of other projects in between, and working with a visual language which is much more sophisticated. And I think that's the big shift, really, is that the kind of visual language that we're using now is much more complex and much more sophisticated across the board than it was then.
Yeah. Well, I you know, we could sort of perhaps deal with that now since we're on the subject, and then we can move back. But it was one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, because your students had their show quite recently, and it struck me that without exception they were dealing with, you know, a kind of, like you say, a visual language which was, I think when I did photojournalism, wouldn't have even been recognised, and people would go, well, what the hell are you doing? That's not what we're doing here, you know? Yeah, and it seems like now that's almost become, you know,
that's
the norm.
The default.
What do you sort of, do you encourage them directly to
experiment? The way I try to often describe what we're trying to produce, as it were, I'm very open-ended about the kind of work they do, the issues that they deal with, the ideas and so on. But what I try to think we're trying to do is take the kind of best of journalistic practice. So stories that are about something relevant and urgent and important. Now, that could be about, you know, your own family, or it could be about, you know, environmental issues, or it could be about a conflict, or whatever it might be, so a major social issue. It can be very personal as well, but it has to be about something that's kind of tangible and that you can kind of get a grip on. So Mick, then add to that the kind of rigor of the academy, so the rigor of the academic practice, so properly researched, you know, well thought through, coherent, well argued, you know, you're able to kind of, talk about what you do, whether that's in writing or whether it's in a conversation, or whether it's talking to a client, or whether it's talking to somebody else, like an expert. You know, you really understand the intricacies of what it is that you're dealing with. So it's kind of robust and well-researched, and you can defend your ideas and your research process and so on. And then add to that a kind of conceptual, philosophical basis on which the project is formulated. And so, you know, that's essentially kind of taking some of that kind of fine art documentary methodology of having a kind of big idea that underlies the practice.
Yeah.
And then most importantly, not trying to find some kind of visual gimmick or visual formal strategy or trick and then try and find a story to fit it to, but rather the other way around. So it's let the story that you're working on, or the idea or the concept, determine the way that you should visualize that. So find the right visual strategy for the particular thing that you're working on. And then obviously find the right dissemination strategy for that. So don't just do a book by default, but if book is the right format to get your work across, maybe it's installation, maybe it's web-based, maybe it is an editorial story, maybe it's a participatory project, you know, where you're working with a community. So really trying to join all those dots up together. So it's a really coherent kind of worldview, as it were, of who you are as a person and as a photographer, and of what you're trying to achieve with the piece of work that you're doing.
Do you think that all that stuff and the importance of the concept and everything means, in a way, that the quality of the individual images is less important than it used to be?
Well, we don't work in single pictures on the course, and just so that people know, it's the MA Photojournalism and Photography at London College of Communication, so we get that.
I'll put it in the intro, it's worth saying. Yeah.
But we don't really work anymore in single pictures, so we are working on bodies of work.
Mm.
But obviously within that, we're still looking for strong photography and strong individual images. So I think that, you know, we're not playing down the significance of the single photograph on its own, but we are hopefully trying to set it within a context of a larger body of work. So
I'm asking for a friend, Paul, because I'm sort of trying to put something together, and I just gave it away. I talked to Christopher Anderson yesterday, asked him the same question in a way, and it was we had a little discussion about, you know, really what is a good photograph, but back to you. So here we are, we were at the late 80s. Now, you were there for the Berlin Wall.
Yeah.
So that must have been quite an early
That was very early on, yeah. That was 89.
Was that your first big...
Yeah, that was the first big story. I mean, I covered Belfast, which was a big global story, and it got me my first couple of big publications. I had a double-page spread in the Observer magazine, I think, with a picture from the Trump, you know, from one of the... the marching nights in Belfast. But I'd managed to, bizarrely enough, start working for the Sunday Telegraph newspaper. I'd been friends with Justin Layton, who is now a very successful car photographer, living a very glamorous life, jetting around the world, photographing Mercedes in front of ice floes and so on.
I see his car photographs on social media and admire them. Yeah,
absolutely. But at the time, he was a news photographer like myself. And he'd, again, been working for the Sunday Telegraph newspaper. And through him, I'd kind of met the picture editor, Alex Brummer, once or twice. And then who'd said, well, if you get anything good, let me know, send me something in. And then there was a student demonstration in front of the Houses of Parliament on a Saturday. This must have been in the summer of 89, I think, probably. Anyway, it all kicked off and, riots started. And there was a moment when a police van was being pelted with bottles. And there was a bunch of bobbies standing in front of it, very ill prepared, not even in riot gear, I don't think. And the Houses of Parliament in the background. And I got a picture of that and went straight back to the paper with it and said, I think I've got a good picture. And it ended up making the front page of the Sunday Telegraph newspaper. And that was my kind of big in to that newspaper then, because I got this kind of dramatic news picture. So there was a very strange period when, one of the most right-wing Tory newspapers in the country, pretty much the entire picture desk were raving Marxists and lefties, And actually, I was talking about this the other day with a couple of friends, and especially thinking about it in terms of the Trump coverage of the Trump election. It's hard to think of many overtly right-wing photojournalism documentary photographers. I actually can't think of anybody. And I think the predominant sort of, you've got right-wing writers, you've got right-wing journalists, you've got right-wing TV pundits, you've got right-wing radio hosts, but I can think of very few overtly right-wing or even covertly right-wing photographers in the field, and very few bodies of work that are pro, as it were, that side. So it was kind of an irony, but it meant that I got fantastic.
Why do you think that is, though? I mean,
I don't know what it is. I mean, I suppose maybe it's something to do with the nature. I don't see how it can be something to do with the nature of photography, but it does seem that, I think it's mostly because photojournalism concerns itself with social issues, I guess.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Because of that, the type of people that are attracted to it have some sense of social injustice. And not that I'm necessarily saying that right-wing people can't have a sense of injustice in the world, but predominantly your worldview is more liberal, left, humanist, if you like, than it is, a right-wing view. And I guess that goes back a lot to the founding fathers and the founding days, people like Jacob Rees and Lewis Hine. And in fact, I've just been doing some research on the early days of Magnum and, Kappa, Chim and who was then called Cartier, not even Cartier-Bresson, were all members of the, were all either members of or very closely associated with the Communist Party in France. And they were all staff photographers for Ce Soir, which was the communist daily newspaper.
Right.
So they were all essentially, very much on the left, hardcore left of politics at the time.
Yeah, and then there's that the whole kind of tradition of the concerned photographer, which was a kind of notion that came out
absolutely
of Magnum tradition.
But anyway, coming back to that, so that was my into the Sunday Telegraph. And so I started working fairly regularly for them doing, feature stories. And the rhythm of a weekly newspaper is actually quite a nice one because you do kind of feature shoots during the week, and then on the Friday and Saturday is the kind of news days when, and obviously on the Saturday is the big news day, and if that's when you go out and do the demos and events in London, and you're looking for the kind of news picture to get it back by 2 o'clock to get it onto the page. I mean, that's a funny thing, of course. Nowadays, these sort of deadlines are almost irrelevant. But back in the day, you had to get your film processed. You had to get it back to the paper and get it processed. So there's always a time lag. So you're always thinking, I've got to get my shot by about 1 o'clock to be able to get back to the office in time to get it in, because the last editions went off in the afternoon. And the other one was, I was talking about this the other day to somebody, was the Friday, I think it was 11 a.m. Concorde to New York. Got there in time to make Time and Newsweek's deadline to come out on the Saturday for that week's edition. So just the idea of, this glamorous world of, shipping your film. And I mean, the strange thing then, saying again, somebody you wouldn't even believe today, but, those days I was shooting mostly slide film when I was working as a colour news photographer. And so you would have bags of film that you would be, sending back from wherever you were, whatever kind of troubled zone you were in. So you would literally go to the airport and look for a sort of middle-class English person and say to them in the check-in, excuse me, I'm working for the Observer, do you mind, would you carry this film back for me? And then a courier will be on the other end to meet you at the airport. Can you give me your name? And, imagine giving somebody a bag of film now, and asking them to carry it through security.
Giving them anything to carry through.
Exactly. So anyway, so to come back to the Berlin Wall, so I had been you know, working quite successfully by that point for the Telegraph, and was getting quite a lot of daily work for them. And I very distinctly remember it, you know, I was in the, those days when I was, because I thought I was a photojournalist, you never know what might happen. So I always carried my passport, my toothbrush and my camera bag, you know, just in case. And I went into the office in the morning, and on the news it was breaking that Honecker had announced that the Berlin Wall was going to open up, and that was it. So I said to Alex, can I go? And in those days he was great that he, you know, he would give you a plane ticket and a day, and then let's see what happens. So basically he guaranteed, you know, that you weren't going to lose any money on it. So I basically got on the first plane out to Berlin and landed, you know, pretty much, I think I got there actually the morning after the wall was coming down, and sort of, you know, got those first moments of people smashing it down with hammers and pickaxes, and then people kissing in front of the wall, and all the Easties coming over and, you know, buying bananas and looking back through the wall and so on. And from that I got my first cover picture in a magazine, which was the cover of The Economist of a bunch of flowers in a hole in the Berlin Wall, which is a kind of, for me, was a big coup because it was the first time I'd had a you know, magazine cover. And in fact, I ended up staying out in Eastern Europe for about a month because I stayed in Berlin for about a week, and then the domino effect was starting. And so, you know, I went down to the Czech, what was still Czechoslovakia, but to Prague and Brno, and then to Budapest, following one of the Telegraph reporters kind of doing the chain of events that were happening. So it was a very kind of, you know, it was away for about 3 weeks, I think, in the end on that assignment.
Mm-hmm. And then at some point, I mean, the thing that I guess you're probably the best known for is the work you did during the Balkans mm-hmm. war conflict. How did that come about initially?
Well, The really big story that really got me a kind of reputation as a news photographer internationally was the Romanian Revolution, which was very shortly afterwards, obviously, from the Berlin Wall.
Of course.
And that, again, was very much down to Alex at the Telegraph. I was due to do the Lord Mayor's... I'd gone into the office for the Christmas shift, I think, and we saw, you know, the news breaking that Ceausescu had been arrested. And Alex, with Daily Telegraph, and I think it was The Express, that would together, the three papers chartered a private jet for six of us. So there was myself, two of the photographers, and three writers from the papers. And we flew out to Vanya in Bulgaria, which is a small kind of seaside town near the Romanian border, arriving in the middle of the night. And obviously there was, you know, the flight plan had just been filed, and these Bulgarian, you know, customs officials were like very bemused by these strange guys with all this kit. But they were fine. They kind of, you know, let us in. And then we got a train, an overnight train to Bucharest, fully expecting we'd get picked up at the border because he thought, you know, you've just got to try and get in by any means possible. I remember sitting in the carriage, you know, with all our gear and, you know, sort of obviously very Western style, you know, puffer jackets and everything. And the customs guard came in and looked us up and down quite suspiciously. And we all thought we were going to get lifted and arrested and deported or whatever. Took all our passports and looked at them very carefully and then smiled and stamped them and said, "Welcome to free Romania." You know, and that was it. And we got in. So that was right into the kind of maelstrom of what in retrospect probably was less of a coup, of more of a coup than a popular revolution. But, you know, we went straight into the center of Bucharest and, you know, the revolution was happening. And so I got a good set of pictures out of that, managed to cover the story. And to me, it was just extraordinary, this idea of, you know, civilians, you know, taking up weapons to defend themselves and to kind of overthrow a dictator. And that was the kind of what I tried to get across in the pictures, you know. So I remember making pictures in the TV station of the very first broadcast of free Romanian television, and getting into the presidential palace where I took a picture of a bunch of the revolutionaries all in kind of very strange mixes of clothing, quasi-military, quasi-civilian. And one guy was on the phone in this beautiful kind of anteroom looking like he's ordering a pizza. You know, we've taken over now. What do we do? Mm-hmm. We know what do we do. And one really defining moment for me, I've always remembered, I was on the street and a truck started driving down. I could see a crowd of people kind of behind. It was driving very slowly down the street. And as it drove past, I realized they were throwing copies of the first free Romanian newspaper out of the back, just like confetti. And people were grabbing this and desperately devouring this news because they'd never had an independent news up until that point. So it was a kind of moment of, you know, kind of celebration of the value of independent journalism. It was a very special one.
Mm. And did you sort of feel like you'd found your calling in a way at that point? I mean, was it a very instinctive?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, I'd covered two, you know, big global news events, and as I said, as a historian, I mean, what I always try to do with my journalistic work was try and work out what is it about this situation that is unique and it's different and it's kind of, in a sense, going to go down in the history books. So I kind of, I suppose I used some of my training in trying to analyze what were the forces at work in any particular situation and try to capture that in the photographs as best I could. Obviously, you know, you're doing it in real time, you know, you haven't got the benefit of hindsight. But, you know, so the Romanian Revolution was this idea of a kind of a people's revolution. That's what I tried to capture. And the Berlin Wall coming down again was this kind of, you know, sense of new hope and so on. Although, ironically, of course, that's not what happened there in the last 20 years. So the big breakthrough after that was... I got a job with the European newspaper, Robert Maxwell's eventually ill-fated newspaper for Europe. But Stuart Nicol, who'd been taken on to set up the team there, I think was looking for a young, you know, slightly crazy photographer who could go and run around and do all sorts of jobs and so on. And invited me to come and talk to him about joining the startup team. So that was an incredibly exciting and amazing experience to be part of a new publication, even if it was Maxwell. And that was a golden kind of period of a couple of years. I was a contract photographer for the paper. So between sort of 1990 and 1992, on assignment practically all the time, shooting color. Because I think one of the things I became quite good at and quite well known for, and one of the first people to do in Britain anyway, was colour slide news photography. Because most of the newspaper photographers here grew up shooting black and white, and the European, we shot slide, so we had this chance to kind of really push sort of colour. You know, so I started out in black and white, but then switched to colour and spent, you know, quite a big chunk of my time working as a kind of colour news reportage photographer.
Mm. So you, I knew, so you had a little bit of financial security there if you were on a contract.
Yeah,
you didn't,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely. Yeah,
you could just concentrate on.
Yeah, I mean, I was on. I think the original contract was 50 days a year, but I ended up doing a lot, you know, way more than that. And there were moments when once I remember getting off a plane, you know, at the airport with a bag of exposed film and giving it to a courier who gave me a bag of fresh film and said, "Get back on the next plane to wherever the next assignment was."
Exciting.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, it was a huge range of stories as well. I mean, from obviously kind of, you know, hardcore news and social issues to covering, because the European was kind of interested in all sorts of things. You know, I remember doing the New Year party in Gstaad with all the kind of wealthy European, you know, hoi polloi, and even doing a kind of paparazzi shoot in Madrid of some, you know, wealthy socialite, Spanish socialite who was in some scandal. So I kind of did the whole gamut of European sort of European values, really.
You know? Yeah. Well, I was looking back at my old World Press annuals, you know, there you were featuring pretty heavily at one point, Paul, for a certain number of years. I think you did a thing in Kazakhstan, which was about the sort of the kind of legacy of nuclear fallout, or however you want to put it, and also Somalia, which was, you know, a very pretty horrific scenario. What was the sort of timeline there?
When Maxwell died, the Europeans started to kind of fall apart and work started to ease off, but I still had a little bit of work from them, and they were good enough to kind of give me the odd day or two to get stories started. But then by that point I was also pretty well established with network, and because I'd built up a decent reputation and my work had been getting published, you know, globally, you know, I had a kind of clients that kind of buy into me and kind of believed in me, I suppose, in a way. And so the Kazakhstan story, I'd gone out through the European, I think about a year or 6 months previously, to do a story about a big anti-nuclear congress that was taking place in Kazakhstan. And it was kind of as the country was opening up, really. It was, you know, I did a lot of work in the former Soviet Union around that period of kind of glasnost and perestroika as these nations were becoming independent, you know, in the Baltics and so on. And it was when Kazakhstan had just become independent. And so it was trying to deal with the nuclear legacy, because Kazakhstan was one of the main testing sites for the Soviet nuclear weapons program, a town called Semipalatinsk, which was a few hours drive from the capital. So I'd gone out to cover this conference for the European, and at that conference we were taken on a day trip out to visit Semipalatinsk for a big demonstration with the local Kazakh kind of people and so on. And at that I realized the extent of what had happened there, and it was kind of a pretty untold story. You know, it hadn't really been documented very much. And so I set some contacts up on that first trip and then said I'd love to come back, you know. So I went back for about a month in, I guess it must have been the winter of beginning of 92, I think. and was on my own basically in this very remote part of Kazakhstan covering this story, and got amazing access. I mean, people were very open, and I managed to even, you know, blag my way through various bottles of vodka and contacts into what had been a top secret nuclear establishment until, you know, a year previously, and got the commander to take me out to ground zero where the nuclear weapons had been tested. So it was a very, it was a difficult story, because it was very, you often work with a fixer, and obviously I'm sure you know fixers are the kind of unsung heroes of what we do. But the woman I was working with was just a local translator. She was a very, very nice middle-aged woman who I managed to get connected with. And we were going around houses looking for families whose children, because there was a very high rate of birth defects caused by the pollution and the exposure to radiation and so on. And it was very difficult, because you were basically walking into somebody's house sort of saying, have you got a disabled child and how bad are they? And one of the problems with doing this kind of work is, and the same would apply to things like Somalia and so on, is, you know, the story, you know, you're trying to get the most powerful representation of the story. And that's often something that's quite uncomfortable and unpleasant, and but you're going to look for it. Mm. So, you know, you have this moral dilemma of this, you know, to drive the story and drive interest in the story and drive the effect of the story, you're looking for the most, you know, dramatic cases, but that means you're also sort of pushing the boundaries ethically about what you're trying to get.
You can feel like a bit of a vulture.
You can feel it's a challenge, definitely. And there were moments. In fact, it got to the point where what I had to do was say to the fixer, "Can you go into the house of this family first and talk to them a little bit and just see what the situation is? And if the child is relatively speaking okay, then we won't push them, we won't talk to them very much, but, you know, let me know." So it kind of was almost like, you know, find the worst cases, but that's what the story was about. You need the worst cases too. And there was one very shocking case of a child with this hydroencephalitis, I think it's called, with this giant balloon sized head that was just like something out of a horror movie, you know, and other kids with horrible kind of tumors and so on. But they made powerful pictures, and the story, you know, the story did run very widely, and it was published in The Observer and Life magazine and things like that, and, you know, got me a reputation beyond just doing the news photography. It was kind of the first big feature story, still related to the news, still kind of current affairs, but that I had published.
And what about Somalia? Was that the same year or the year after?
Yeah, so Somalia was the summer of 92, and that was the first sort of big story I took on in black and white, for a range of reasons, partly because I wanted to try that out, but also because Gideon Mendel had just been out to Somalia for Network and had shot colour, so there was a space there to do that. I went out, I ended up teaming up with Christy Perkins, and, you know, often when you work in the field in these sort of situations, you do end up buddying up with another photographer. Mostly other photographers, because journalists typically, unless you're on assignment with the journalist, you know, their agenda, their rhythm is often quite different to ours. And TV crews tend to be just too big and too complicated. So quite often you end up traveling with another photographer, which sounds counterintuitive. You think, oh, you'd be competing with each other. But generally speaking, you're not, because you've each got your own. Even if you're in exactly the same location, you're each going to make your own pictures and approach it in your own way.
And there's a kind of perfect illustration, really, because one of your most well-known pictures, which is on the cover of your latest book, you were standing shoulder to shoulder with Chris, more or less, at the same scenario.
Absolutely,
there's two little boys looking through a metal kind of gate, and one of them's just literally his eye through a bullet hole. And and that was part of the set of pictures that you won the World Press for that particular year. But then Chris's picture is on the cover of that.
That's right,
which is kind of weird. And his pictures don't feature in that, because I was looking at it, obviously, in preparation. Yeah. So, yeah, that's where you get a sense of, oh, they both were obviously there at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I also shot, you know, I was very aware of that. I think, again, possibly because of my background, in university, I was very aware of the context in which we work as media people. I know, you know, there is this sort of, you know, illusion that these images are taken by some sort of, you know, that you're not there, almost like kind of robot does it or something. And so I did just started doing quite a lot of work around the media world as well. So I did a picture then of a line. I mean, I was one of them. There was a child, a very ill-looking child, who's being photographed by a group of photographers, and I'd taken the picture. Then I stepped back and photographed them photographing the scene, and I was very aware of that sort of sense in which we are part of the story. We are there, we are a presence, but we're also kind of in a way invisible. Yeah. So trying to open that fourth wall up a little bit of what's been going on. And I did a lot of that in Bosnia, for example.
And in a way, were you sort of trying to, you know, allude to your own discomfort in a bit of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think so, yeah. Because I was very aware that I was part of that world and that world is problematic, but also that world has a very important job to do. So I think it's a very, you know, you're walking this very fine tightrope all the time between, you know, the urgency of the story and getting across the story as honestly and authentically as you can and showing the, you know, the what's happening to the to your best ability and the kind of ethical problems around, as you know, victimization and exploitation and so on and so forth.
Do you feel that that's basically still the same, or do you think that's changed in some way?
I think the fundamental questions are very similar. You know, I think, you know, people ask me the question a lot, you know, do you intervene, and, you know, why didn't you pick up the starving child kind of thing, you know, and by and large, you know, my position most of the time is that, you know, you're there professionally for a very specific role. You know, you're there as a professional witness to these events. You're there as a journalist or as a photographer, and your job is to record as authentically as you can your sense of what's going on. So you're that kind, you know, you're one of the different, I mean, I've talked about in my writing a bit about this idea of a network of trusted witnesses. So there's a whole, you know, I wouldn't say to anybody, believe me, but I would say, look at me and the person next to me and the other photographer and the other journalist and triangulate between them, you know, a sense of what you think is going on. So that's our role, is to kind of provide that information in different ways and with different viewpoints, of course. And for the audience then to try and sift through that information and make sense of it through kind of a range of different outlets. So what our job is not is to be an aid worker or to be an NGO advocate or to be, it may go towards that, but we're not there in the field as, you know, a doctor or as a security expert or as a, you know, a logistics organizer. And in fact, you know, in particularly in famine situations, you know, if you give a severely malnourished child your energy bar from your pocket, you could kill it because, you know, they have very strict nutrition and rehydration protocols with very specific food that you're supposed to, you know, supposed to give in very specific amounts. And, you know, you could literally kill a starving child if you tried to give it food that was not appropriate. And so, and also most of the photographs that we see of these sort of situations are, because of the logistics of it, taken in some sort of feeding center where there is an infrastructure there. Now, that infrastructure may be being stretched, it may be under, it may be having a lot of problems, but it is there. There are usually MSA, you know, doctors or aid workers and so on in the space in some way or other. So you're not the only person responsible for the safety and succor of that particular individual.
Yeah.
And also, at the end of the day, what tends to happen is the photographer or the journalist gets blamed, not the fact that we've allowed the situation to happen in the first place. So it's a little bit kind of, you know, it's a bit unfair really to blame us for allowing the situation to happen in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, it is a very difficult kind of moral dilemma. And when you do see the image of, you know, where someone has stepped back and photographed the photographers, there is something very kind of troubling about it. It does seem, almost sometimes seem kind of grotesquely exploitative, you know, and I guess we all have to deal with those
But, you know, on the other hand, imagine how else could you do it, you know?
Right.
I mean, somebody has to be there to take the picture. It's not a drone, you know, it's not a robot.
Right.
So there has to be an infrastructure and a mechanism by which these images get made. And then the question then is, if they didn't exist, would we be... even worse,
I think
off,
it's
would
that,
these situations be even more.
Yeah, you know. I think what's troubling is that there's obviously a competitiveness between the photographers. So what you're dealing with are a bunch of guys who are you know, competitive
and girls.
Guys and girls. Sorry, yeah, guys and girls who are competitive people who are trying to do their job as best they can, and who maybe you know, within all that, might forget the fact that there's a starving kid standing there wondering why. What all
I don't think necessarily they forget it, and the competitiveness is there, but. But it's also it also drives in some ways what we do, you know, because, you know, that's why you push things that bit further to get, you know, to places that you wouldn't otherwise go to, perhaps, and so on. And I mean, I think, you know, there've been a couple. There are occasions when people start getting, you know, pushing people out of the way and that kind of thing. But my philosophy then was always, you know, if you're not the first to a scene, then walk away and go and find something else, because there's always something else going on in those sort of new situations that's interesting. And getting into a kind of scrum of people fighting to get the same picture, is definitely
Well, in a way, you've sort of answered the question, because that is what you can do, is that, you know, if someone's got that.
Exactly.
There was a particularly difficult example of all this in Haiti in recent years, where a young girl was shot, and you know, that did create a lot of, I think, discussion, you know, which is obviously something to you know, the discussion that should be had, I think. Mm. Yeah. Mm. So Somalia was, how did you find that situation? Was it difficult? I mean, was it?
What I was trying to do, I remember very distinctly that my motivation there was, you know, most famines are man-made, you know, even though they might be sold as if they're kind of great natural disasters. But with Somalia, it seemed to be particularly clear that it was a man-made, you know, situation. It was created because of the, you know, Somalia was this pawn in the superpower game. And then when the Cold War kind of collapsed, the Russians had armed it, the Americans had armed them, they had all sorts of different alliances and so on. And then Somalia was no longer that important, so that had all fallen away and the country had collapsed. But it was still very heavily armed and all these kind of militias and warlords had sprung up. And so I wanted to try and photograph that because it seemed to be, you could very clearly in that situation show how it was a man-made disaster and therefore it could be solved by intervention rather than by, you know, some, you know, appealing to some kind of, you know, laws of nature kind of thing. And so that was very much what I was trying to do photographing there. The security situation was very difficult, obviously, because it was full of warlords. And, you know, in order to be able to travel around, one of the reasons why you buddied up with someone is you had to basically hire your own technical. And a technical was a Jeep or a Toyota pickup with a 50 cal on the back and a bunch of goons with Kalashnikovs. And you quite quickly realized that actually they weren't there to protect you. They were there to protect the vehicle that you were driving around yeah. in. But, you know, we drove around in these technicals and we would drive to different locations and, you know, go to various aid centers and aid camps run by MSF and UNICEF and so on. And photograph. And it was difficult because, you know, you could go to the market and find an abundance of food, but it was controlled by a warlord and the kind of the people that didn't have any access to that were literally starving and dying, whereas the kind of the elites that were controlling it could have whatever they wanted.
Mm. Yeah. So it's the way in which famine is used as a kind of tool.
Yeah, it's a tool of, exactly, a tool of conflict. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's episode 1. Episode 2 of this chat coming soon.